Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We're broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. You can watch this program by going to the Ustream channel and then just search for Gary Nall. Many of you are listening over the telephone from all across the United States, and I want to thank the 485,000 listens last month alone, making it the number one listened to radio program in the entire United States and Canada by telephone, and second only in the world. 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. I realize that thousands of people each day tune in for the first time. Why should you be listening to this program? Because the Progressive Commentary Hour takes on serious topics. It is a program that is different. It is not a chit-chat show. It does not deal with the basic headlines, nor does it have a biased perspective. Instead, we simply look at problems that are just beyond the grasp of the mainstream media and those in positions of power. And we invite remarkable minds on this program to share their insights. More often than not, the people that we have, you have rarely or never heard them or seen them in the mainstream media. They generally don't belong to the corporate left or corporate right think tanks and NGOs that are really there as spokespersons for the official truths that we know. Today, our program will devote itself to an issue that is rarely discussed, and that is moving beyond Occupy and the need to spiritualize political, social, and environmental activism towards building a post-capitalist society. For many, that is simply a utopian dream, not possible when you consider that those in power, about 3,000 corporations and individuals, but the core of that power is held by about 165 major institutions. And from that core, they have established foundations, think tanks, substantial control within academic circles. They fund and chair a lot of departments in different universities. They have a revolving door between those who are in the academic community as well as those who are supportive of all of the other areas of our society. So no matter where you turn, you're always going to have one of their experts telling you what we should believe in. And hence, whether it's in Syria, whether we should go in and invade it, or whether we should look for something else, it's always their perspective, never a progressive perspective. I remember last year when I went to Zuccotti Park on the very first day of the Occupy movement. I was inspired by how many young people in their late teens and early 20s that I met. I was also inspired by the idea that they were there to protest principally those instruments that were the head of globalization, some of the major banks. But that was about the extent of my inspiration. Because when I ask many of the individuals, can you be more specific? What exactly are you against and what are you for? And they said, well, we're against globalization. I said, as am I. But can you be more specific? Well, the major corporations, and I said, all right, but there's a contradiction here. I see that you're wearing a shirt. Is that made in the United States with union labor, or is it made somewhere where there is a living wage earned? And I said, look at my shirt. And I pulled my collar aside, and it said, made in the USA. I said, that is also true for my pants, my shoes, my socks, my underwear. Because I support by my actions. I said, do you eat organic food? I see you're eating a McDonald's. You're drinking a Coca-Cola. You're wearing Nike sneakers. You have a Tommy Hilfiger hat on. So which part of globalization are you actually against? You're smoking their cigarettes. If you look in your wallet, and I ask them to take out the wallet of three of the people, they had all the credit cards, the very banks that they said they were protesting. And I said, I appreciate that you're protesting these banks, but why do you still do business with them? And that became a very contentious point, and they began to argue the issue. And I said, I just want to understand if you're really actualizing. How far does this message go? And I went down about another 20 times over the next couple of months. and I didn't see that change very much. So to me, it was a bit disappointing. It was also disappointing that they hadn't organized the other students around the campuses in the United States to form at least one principled movement, get all students in the United States to protest the rates of increase in tuition, the interest rates on student loans, and the fact that you could not discharge your debt with bankruptcy. And if you got the teachers in solidarity and their unions, and you got the students together, that was something I believe that all students and all teachers could support as a common cause. But that never happened. And I felt that was a missed opportunity. That said, I'd like to welcome my panelists who are here today to explore this in depth. The rest of the program, we'll be hearing from them. We have the Reverend Matthew Fox. He is one of the nation's most progressive theologians and spiritual visionaries. He is the visionary behind what is called the creation spirituality, an ecumenical and inner spiritual theology that posits life as an original blessing. For years, the last pope, Benedict, also known as Cardinal Ratzinger, the chief inquisitor and head of the Vatican's Congregation of Doctrine and Faith, tried to silence Reverend Fox, which eventually led to his being expelled from the Dominican order and his subsequent joining of another church, the Anglican, or a church. He is the author of at least a dozen books on theology, biblical themes, mysticism, and inner faith. He is joined by Dr. David Corton. Dr. Corton is the co-founder of Yes Magazine, co-chair of the New Economy Working Group, and founder and president of the Living Economies Forum. He's a member of the Club of Rome and an associate of the International Forum on Globalization. He has served as a faculty member of Harvard University's Graduate School of Business and was an advisor to Harvard's Central American Institute in Nicaragua. And after leaving academia, Dr. Corton spent 15 years in Southeast Asia with the Ford Foundation, serving as its Asia Regional Advisor on Development, and he has contributed much and is the author of many important works as well. In addition, we have Adam Bucco. He is a social activist, a spiritual director to many of the New York City's homeless youth. Adam grew up in Poland during the totalitarian regime and explored the anarchistic youth movement as a force for social political change. And after immigrating to the United States, Adam began to journey into spiritual activism, having worked with the ashram of the poor in India and working on the streets of American cities with young people struggling against homelessness and prostitution. He is the co-founder of the Reciprocity Foundation, award-winning nonprofit dedicated to transforming the lives of New York City's homeless, and he helps them with their lives. More recently, he founded HAB, an inner-spiritual contemplative fellowship for young people, to develop a radical spirituality that incorporates activism. He is also an author, and he writes frequently for several of the magazines, including Sojourner. Nice to have you all with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Yeah, delighted.
Although tomorrow is the second anniversary of the Occupy movement, and it was an indicator of sentiments held by many people, and particularly youth, both in the United States and abroad, I believe that we still need to move beyond many of the Occupy's original values in order to infuse social-political activism with a spiritual base that addresses the serious and urgent challenges we face. And it's not simply the corruption and market manipulation of Wall Street, but rather the entire system that defines a postmodern way of perceiving ourselves in the world, that dictates the way we are supposed to live our lives and defines humanity's relationship to the earth, that poses our greatest threats. Therefore, I want to focus on the values that we need to infuse into our activism and explore an alternative social, political, and economic world where spiritual values, not necessarily religious values, predominates. I believe it was George Lakoff at the University of California, Berkeley, that speaks about framing, which is the way our messages are outlined psychologically and ethically in order to capture the moral argument that best play upon people's conscience. And in so doing, the treachery of the present system as heartless and utterly lacking compassion is framed in a more concise way for people to act on. So, in light of what we first witnessed with Occupy 2 years ago, and how it was splintered and dispersed since then, I'd like each of you in turn to address activism's problems and or failures to frame in a spiritual context the threats from our ruling system, and then how would activism change if it embraced those values more thoroughly. I'm going to begin with you, Reverend Fox, and then we'll go to Adam and David. And one last just addition to this. And as you all know, once I do a long introduction, I stay quiet for the program. What would Gandhi do or Martin Luther King do if he were part, or each one of them were part, of the Occupy movement? The forum is yours.
Well, again, I want to thank you for having us on the program. As you say, this is the eve of the second anniversary of Occupy in New York. And Adam and I have just put out this book called Occupy Spirituality, Radical Vision for a New Generation, so the timing is great. It's always good to be with David Corton. He's one of the real important thinkers on this planet today who's really put forward a plan for an economics that works for everyone, not just the two-legged ones, but that's important for all two-legged ones, not just the few, but for all the creatures on the earth, because we're in this together and we're only going to survive if we're in this together and are really aware of our interdependence with, our responsibility with the ocean, the soil, the forests, the four-legged ones, and so forth. So it's a pleasure to be with both of you. So the question is, I like how you put it, the system we have is heartless and lacking in compassion. If you look at the world spiritual tradition, this word compassion keeps coming up. The Dalai Lama says we can do away with all religion, but we can't do away with compassion. And in the Jewish and Christian tradition, compassion is the heart of the Jewish moral law and also of Jesus' teaching. In Luke 6, he says, be you compassionate as your Creator in heaven is compassionate, because in the Jewish tradition, compassion is in fact the secret name for God. But compassion also in Hebrew as well as in Arabic comes from the word for womb. So there's something about mammals. So there's something about the womb people that that calls for compassion. It's that sense of kinship and family and caring and forgiving and healing and justice. The prophets of Israel and the prophets of humanity, like Meister Eckhart, says compassion means justice. And this is what I really like about Occupy. I think that it's true, they do not your plan. But I think essentially the essence of Occupy is that it is a testimony about the intuition of justice and injustice. And that's the bottom line, it seems to me. Is what we are doing balanced and just and therefore sustainable, or is it not? Yesterday was the anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and $22 trillion was lost in our economy when that rock started down the slippery slope. And, of course, you can see everywhere that it's the Main Street, it's ordinary people that have lost the money. Wall Street is, in fact, further ahead now than they were before Lehman Brothers collapsed. So as you say, it's heartless and it's scary, and it's certainly lacking in compassion. All the unemployment, underemployment, and the continued rape of nature that goes on in the name of a consumer capitalism that is no longer viable or sustainable. So that's my response to your question.
Okay. And Adam, would you speak next, please?
Yes. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share. It's a pleasure to be with you, David, and Matt. You know, my experience of Occupy was different. As you mentioned, I work with New York City homeless kids. And when When Zuccotti Park started, when the occupation started, many of those kids decided to leave homeless shelters and move to Zuccotti Park simply because they felt dehumanized in those shelters. They felt that they were not given opportunities there to heal, to develop their lives, their passion, and etc. So they went to Zuccotti Park, and they went there to essentially create what they said, what they called a new world. Now, once they moved there, they became part of these small circles and communities, and all of a sudden they discovered that, you know, their gifts are being appreciated. They kind of almost by accident stumbled upon this spiritual methodology which allowed them to wake up to what their gifts are and use them in service of their community. So for my kids, that experience was a life-changing experience. You know, just recently, a few weeks ago, I was in Istanbul, and I went to Occupy Istanbul, which was happening at Gezi Park. Again, it was the same experience. I met there with a community of homeless kids. Seven of their friends were killed by police, and they were there creating that new world. So as Matt mentioned, that intuition, that there's a new dream that is being born in us, I think is very valuable. And in many ways, that was the gift of Occupy, that it acknowledged that dream in young people. Now, how do we move forward? I think that, for example, when I look at the homeless kids in New York City who were part of the occupation, Occupy gave them spirituality. Occupy gave them a sense of community. Now, what's the next step? I think that we need to essentially now gather people like yourself, Gary, people like Matt and David, people who have skills, and help those kids to essentially connect their intuition for justice, their longings for a better world, their sense of newly found vocations, and connect those longings to proper training so they could learn things like farming, so they could learn how to build sustainable communities, small businesses, and essentially move into this vision that David articulated in his book, The Agenda for a New Economy.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. David, I have a two-part issue. If you would please take us beyond the initial discussion into a more formal explanation, because you've not only had a distinguished career with the current paradigm, teaching at Harvard and working with the Ford Foundation, but you also walked away from it, and you became a leading voice against globalization during the height of the demonstrations against the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. And then you embarked upon an even further journey to reevaluate and the anti-globalization efforts and capitalism with a spiritual perspective that also honors the environment as a living earth. And you have therefore transitioned through several world views and paradigms that very few people have undertaken or experienced, including those in the field. So would you highlight the main realizations that you've had that have led from one perspective to another, and then speak on the difference between trying to fix the current system and embarking upon a creative enterprise to create and enact a new economic system based upon values other than capital, materialism, and consumerism at the local level?
Well, thank you, Gary. You've raised my favorite question, and it's just a delight to be back with you and to also my friends Matt and Adam. You know, I started out my career with a passion to end poverty in low-income countries, what we then called underdeveloped countries. And through a 30-year career working in international development and foreign aid, came to realize that the actual outcome seemed to be pushing people into deeper desperation, and at the same time destroying the environment and also destroying the fabric of once strong cultures. And that led to my inquiry into why is that happening? And it's important for people to understand that my particular disciplinary background is organization. It's not economics. So I'm far less concerned with pricing systems than with how institutions organize and the implications of that for the results that they produce. Now, I do want to comment briefly on Occupy because I think it was one of the most extraordinary movements of recent time. And it accomplished two things. One, particularly in the public mind, it brought inequality to the fore of public consciousness in a way it had not been before. The other thing is, in terms of what the young people were doing, they were actually experimenting with and learning, developing the frameworks for truly living in community within a gift economy framework. So that was not so visible, but it's an important contribution. Now, here's how I see the reality. It really does come back to foundational spiritual principles, and I've learned a lot here from Matt, and I'm often drawn back to this basic scripture of no one can serve two masters. Either he'll serve God or mammon, which to me means either serving life, the spirit of life, or serving money. And that is exactly the issue that we face with our current economic structures. Because if you understand the institutions, how those institutions are structured, their whole purpose is to make money for people who have money. Now, part of our problem is that we've become so conditioned by our education, by the media, to think of money as wealth, and therefore think of people who are making money as creating wealth, that we then buy into this larger frame that if the economy is making money, never mind who for, it is actually producing wealth and creating a foundation for a better life for everyone. Now, you begin to penetrate that illusion by a recognition that money is just simply a number. The money system is an accounting system. Money is not itself wealth. And those trillions, those billions of dollars that disappeared with Lehman Brothers, you know, nothing whatever happened in terms of the real world and its capacity to produce for real needs. It was just a bunch of numbers in a computer file disappeared. And Wall Street's extremely good at essentially manipulating the accounting system to create numbers we call money, which give the holder of those numbers claims on the real wealth of the society, claims on our labor, claims on our intellectual property, claims on our land, our productive capacity. And by organizing the economy around maximizing GDP, which ultimately is maximizing the rate at which money is flowing through the economy, and getting us all caught up in the stock price indices, which is essentially a measure of the growth and diminishing of financial bubbles, we're supposed to listen to the news, and if the stock market's going up, we're supposed to celebrate, wow, we're all getting richer. Now, in fact, what's happening is Wall Street's playing games, manipulating the system so that the 1% or the 1/10th of 1%, the 1/100th of 1% are getting a greater and greater share of the financial claims against the real wealth of the planet. And that is the crux of the inequality. And if you understand the system, that, you know, there is this deep expectation that however much money you have, you should be getting an automatic interest return or profit return on that money, which means for that to happen, you essentially have to be accumulating ever and ever more monopoly control over people's means of living and our access to our means of living, which means our access to food, to education, to shelter, to energy, to all the things that that we need in our daily life. So a lot of the Occupy movement opened up the conversation, but we've got to go way beyond, of course, the Occupy message to a much deeper and more nuanced discussion of where do we get it wrong in terms of the culture, our basic beliefs, how are the institutions structured to assure that the major outcome of any economic activity is to increase the economic and financial power of the very few, and what does a different economy look like? And that's where we get into the spiritual frame. And the idea of life as sacred, of earth as sacred, I'm very taken by the indigenous frame of earth as our sacred mother. This gets into a whole bunch of issues of basic cosmology. In my view, you know, we best know God through how God expresses in creation. And that gets us into a whole framework of the the living self-organizing capacity of the cosmos, how that is expressed in a sacred living earth. And then we begin to think about, wow, if we were to create an economy that is about serving life, about bringing us humans into a co-productive relationship with life, that would look very, very different. It would involve decentralizing production, focusing on people's creating their means of living, growing our food locally, producing our basic goods and clothing and so forth, as you suggest, locally, and recognizing it's not just producing it, it's also providing people with an opportunity to be productive in ways that they can earn their means of living at the same time as contributing to the wealth and possibilities of the whole.
I appreciate that insight, David. I just want to follow up, please. For several decades, I've been directing documentary films exposing the dangers of the drugging of our children, the pharmaceutical industry, vaccination dangers, depleted uranium, Gulf War syndrome, nuclear power, the danger of genetically modified organisms, etc. When I look back at these, each which involves a degree of human ingenuity in developing a technology, I realize that those who espouse these technologies, maybe health through drugs, or energy through nuclear, or coal, or gas hydrofracking, or war under the mirage of spreading democracy, are at the stage of adolescent children who refuse to take responsibility for their actions. They create an act, or act out, but ignore the consequences and then deny any problem or blame, just as a child who stole candy from a store. Therefore, perhaps we can say that modern civilization today is at a stage of early adolescence at best. So would you please imagine what a mature stage of civilization would look like? What would be the values we'd need to awaken to and assimilate in order to evolve beyond our self-destructive, self-absorbed, narcissistic, suicidal path?
Well, you get into some very interesting issues, as usual. One thing to realize is that the people who are making those decisions, each of those dysfunctional technologies or products that you mentioned is profitable. And the people who are making those decisions are working in institutions that create a culture and a reward system, all based on this framework that if you're making money, you are actually benefiting society thereby. Now that's total fallacy, but that's what we get caught up in, and we humans have an enormous capacity for self-justification of our actions and the actions that result in material rewards. And part of it is recognizing how our institutions create that perverse system. It's also important to recognize that, even more than you suggest, I'm quite convinced that many of the people in the positions of greatest power within that system are not just adolescents. They are certifiable psychopaths. They are congenitally, physically incapable of accepting responsibility for their actions, or of experiencing and expressing compassion. Those people, we simply have to get out of positions of power and into places where they can get their needed institutional care. The other piece, though, is recognizing the cultural, the story piece, changing the stories and helping them come to understand the reality of the system that they're working with. But of course, also as implied in your suggestion, if you understand our educational system, if you understand the cultural conditioning within which we grow up, there's just an awful lot in our society that is designed to make sure that we do not move to a more mature level of human moral and psychological consciousness. And that's also a very important piece of it. We could talk about how even academia at the university level suppresses our capacity to recognize our true nature as living beings and to respond with moral responsibility. That's another whole big conversation.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Adam, a follow-up for you, please. On the one hand, we can observe a growing tolerance for other faiths and belief systems among certain segments of our society, and that's a good thing. But then we are also witnessing a powerful series of prejudices and a lack of tolerance, particularly among some of the fundamentalist Christian groups and some of the racist organizations, not that they are one and the same. Even many atheist leaders and groups, especially within the science community, are becoming increasingly intolerant and embrace a radical determinist, reductionist view that I find extremely dangerous. Now, Adam, you shared something, and I'm just going to paraphrase, that while an authentic spiritual seeks diversity, our current socioeconomic system seeks to maintain uniformity. And I think we can witness this clearly in the privatization of education and mandated testing, and more recently with the widespread surveillance and spying on citizens by the National Security Administration, in order to assure that everyone steps the same march and moves to the same drumbeat. And all this serves the needs of a plutocracy determined to maintain control over the flow of wealth and markets and to keep the population entertained and subservient to its leaders. So would you please comment further on how spiritual values, when applied to socioeconomic and educational models, are contrary to the present system that seeks uniformity and control over its bottom line?
Thank you for that question. That's a very good question. And I think that, you know, when I think about this question and what it implies, I look at myself and some of the experiences that I've had in my life, where, you know, for a while I was on this kind of a monastic trip, went to India and wanted to embrace a certain view of spirituality, and that view of spirituality came from very specific religious frameworks and theologies, which essentially asked me to embrace an ideal without respecting the diversity of my feelings of who I am as a person. And we know how it works. You know, essentially, you're supposed to let go of your desires. You're supposed to detach from the world and embrace a specific kind of a vision which allows you to essentially be peaceful and divine, you know? That's the framework that is being given. This framework manifests on many different levels, you know? And what I discovered is that essentially whenever you have a framework like that, you embrace just certain elements of your values, of your longings, and then you push everything under. And what happens when you push those things under, essentially, eventually, they come up and they hijack your life, you know? And I think that any kind of healthy spirituality and healthy psychology, instead of asking us to just pay attention to some parts of ourselves, asks us to acknowledge everything that is alive in us, and asks us to bring all of those things into relationship with each other. And when we do that, something amazing, you know, emerges. Things that our religious systems tell us that are problematic all of a sudden become sources of creativity and inspiration. And so I think that a healthy spirituality essentially needs to allow us a good contemplative and psychological process which will allow us to invite every part of our being into a circle, acknowledge it, and pay attention to it. And we need to learn how to do it on a personal level. We need to learn how to do it in small communities where everyone can essentially bring all of their heartbreaks, all of their hurts, all of their longings into the circle. And when we can learn how to talk to each other in such a way that we could together acknowledge all of that, pay attention to that, and then sense a direction, how to move forward in a good and holistic way, you know? And so I think that it all starts with ourselves, and then it allows us to move forward into small communities, small frameworks and small enterprises, and then eventually that will lead us to address some of the institutional questions, which, as you mentioned, all of our institutions are based on that kind of reductionist framework where we're not supposed to pay attention to certain things, to certain voices, where we're supposed to reject certain beliefs and certain longings that people have.
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate the insight. Matthew, over the past many years, there have been many articles and studies and op-eds addressing the collapse of critical thinking among Americans. And this is not just among the average citizenry, but also those in power, legislators, academics, lawyers, lobbyists, financiers. If people are unable to think critically or choose not to be brought into critical thinking, then how in the world can they make informed choices on what to vote? They are unable to rationalize and see through an illusion that the media dumps out there, nor are they able to discern the truth or falsehood in the news. They are unable to question a doctor's diagnosis intelligently. Basically, they are unable to formulate any coherent sense of deeper meaning in their lives, nor devote themselves to a greater purpose other than struggling to survive and numbing themselves in the process with mindless entertainment and dreaming they can climb the ladder of Big Brother's food chain. So since you've gone up against the Catholic Church, and what a tremendous effort that is, and all of its authority at its highest levels, and understood the power of resistance and denial of change and its silencing of the voices of change, to what degree is the American public collectively a silent majority, a threat to social and environmental well-being and sustainability, and then, and since, according to most polls by the Pew Charitable Trust, showing that Americans are still the most religious nation in the developed world, how can traditional religious beliefs be instilled with deeper spiritual values, particularly those gleaned from the long Christian mystical traditions of love and equality and compassion that you originally mentioned at the beginning of the program, that would lead to more proactive involvement in righting the wrongs of our government and corporate system?
Well, I think you've named the problem very well. I think it's so prevalent that we've invented a word for it in our generation, and that is couch potato-itis. We're taught to be passive. We're taught to take in. We're taught to consume. And this is today's version of the capital sin of gluttony, because we're stuffing ourselves instead of giving birth. Glutus is a Latin word for throat. And we're instead of giving birth to our throat chakras, which is also where we get the word prophet, because prophato means in Greek to speak out, instead of being prophets and warriors on behalf of justice and compassion, including critical thinking, instead of that, we're being taught to be passive and just take in not only all the food we can eat until we explode, but all the nonsense that's poured into us 24/7 by everything from reality shows to constant advertising. So this is part of the system, I think, that David Corton named so well early in this discussion. The whole system invades our being. So how do we wake up? Our ancestors talked about the capital sin of acedia, A-C-E-D-I-A, which often we translated as sloth, but it really means this passivity. Aquinas defined it as a lack of energy to begin new things. It's about lack of energy, and we're rendered passive. Couch potato-itis is that kind of a passive state in terms of citizenship, in terms of thinking, as you say. Academia, in many ways, is bought into this, this compulsion to give kids exams. I've been working for several years with inner-city kids trying to reinvent education from the inner city out. And I developed this value system we call the 10 C's, because in public schools you're not supposed to use religious and spiritual language. So we use the 10 C's, and among them are community. This term has come up a lot tonight. And David Corton's done some really good surveys about how community is really at the center of the value system of most Americans, both right and left, but it seldom gets addressed. So we're talking community, we're talking contemplation, the ability to calm the reptilian brain, so that the mammal brain, which is capable of compassion and kinship, can emerge. Of course, compassion, creativity is the key. We have these kids making movies or working in creativity, and that makes all the difference. This is why so many inner-city kids are dropping out of high school, because they're bored. Once a senior, a black kid, turned to me and said, this is the first time in my 4 years of high school that anyone's asked me to express myself creatively. Now, creativity is at the very heart of what it means to be a human being. This is what distinguishes us from most other species. And yet we don't give it the attention it deserves in education at all. So critical thinking is one of the C's too. And the critical thinking goes with creativity. It goes with contemplation. It's an integral part, using left and right brain together. So you're absolutely right. If we can't develop these values, and that's what they are, and put them out there for the community to debate, and then find ways to pass them on to the younger generation, you know, if we can't do that, we're doomed. Another C is cosmology, the story of how we come here and where here is and how long we've been here. Here we have this silly thing going on in many states about teaching creationism instead of the new cosmology from science that is so off-field and tells us we all come from a 13.8 billion year history. That's significant for young people to hear, that this existence of ours is awesome. So I think this is all part of responding to couch potatoitis and developing critical thinking. And, you know, Einstein says that values do not come from the intellect. He said, and of course, no one can accuse Einstein of being anti-intellectual. They don't come from the intellect. He says, don't make a god of the intellect. But that's exactly what academia has done. He says values come from intuition. And again, this is why I honor the Occupy movement, which, of course, began not in New York, but in Tunisia and Cairo. And, of course, the Cairo occupiers will say that our revolution was hijacked first by the Muslim Brotherhood and now by the army. But they haven't lost their basic intuition about yearning for an authentic democracy, an authentic system of justice, both economic and political.
A follow-up, please, because you've opened a door for me here that encourages me to think on this a little deeper. You have practiced the idea of creating new stories that humanity and our society needs to hear and embrace, ultimately in order to move beyond the current narrative belief of free market capitalism and infinite growth and infinite progress and the narrative of a sky god divining all of nature as subservient to humankind. How dangerous are these stories from the dominant paradigm? And if you could give us some examples of a new story that must be developed and heard.
Are you asking me this?
Yes.
Oh, sure. I think that the story we were given for a couple hundred years, that the universe is a machine, was extremely dangerous because a machine is cold, it's impersonal, it's mechanical, it runs on its own, so to speak. And I think that this killed the spirit, especially of a lot of men. I think the loss of Father Sky as a living place, which is what humans all around the world believe for hundreds of thousands of years. We have the Aboriginals in Australia teach their children that stars are the campfires of the ancestors, and therefore you relate to the stars, and they're looking down on us, seeing how we're doing. So this whole sense of living in a vast universe was killed by the mechanical universe idea. And I think it rendered men to be excessively introvert and to kind of shrink their souls. And we were set up for the Industrial Revolution and all the violence that was done us in that system. And we were set up for the militarism and the obedience, the virtue of obedience that militarism runs on. But with the new cosmology, that in fact, hey, Father Sky is now blown wide open. We now know a star is being born every 15 seconds. So instead of being a cold, impersonal place, the universe is a maternity bed. It's a place of immense creativity that gives permission for both men and women to invest the vast passions of our souls, whether they be about moral outrage or about beauty and joy. There's a place to invest it again. And I think that this story alone, among others from the new science, is very promising because it opens our hearts up. It teaches us to expand what the universe is doing instead of shrink and fit into man-made molds.
Very insightful. Thank you for that. Adam, you've worked very closely with homeless youth, not just in America, but as you mentioned, also in other areas of the world as well. And you were also involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement as many homeless youth took to the demonstrations at Zuccotti Park. Now, members of the older generations have expressed many criticisms toward Generation Y and the millennials, and among those is the lack of spiritual direction and purpose. I'd like to hear your comments based upon your experience of why it's difficult for the older generation to appreciate today's youth and their values, and how it differs from, say, the activism of the 1960s and early 70s of that youth, which many of us were part of, and how you see your spirituality being transformed by the younger generation in order to address the threats they face in the future.
Thank you for that question. So first of all, just to give you an example, you know, when kids come to our center, one of the first things that they usually tell us is, I came here because I think that you can help me to become famous. And the reason why they say that is because several of our students, you know, got on different reality TV shows and became somewhat well known. Now, it's very easy to dismiss that statement as a purely materialistic statement. I want to be famous, you know? And many adults do, and many religious and spiritual institutions, when they hear young people saying that, they immediately want to run away and have nothing to do with them. Now, I investigated what that statement means, you know? And when you get to the bottom of what they're actually saying is, they're actually saying that they want a life of meaning, purpose, and significance. It's just that the only theology that they have is a reality TV theology. And so within that framework, that's what you say. You say, I want to be famous, when you want to express those values, express those longings of being known by another human being, of being appreciated for what you have to contribute to the world and to your community. And so I think that there's a big problem, you know, because all the spiritual institutions, all the spiritual elders, or most of them, are not really willing to diagnose what some of those statements that young people are expressing, what those statements mean. And so for me, it's really important to, instead of just trying to sell young people some kind of a spiritual framework or a spiritual story that they can embrace, instead of that, I would rather focus on exploring their questions and asking their questions. And so, for example, in our center, one of the questions that we ask is, what breaks your heart? What makes you truly alive? You know, who inspires you and why? And when we get to the bottom of what some of those things are, a beautiful vision emerges, where all of a sudden we realize that actually young people are deeply longing for a life of meaning, purpose, and significance. And, you know, older people often say, well, young people are not interested in meditation. They're not interested in going to our churches, our ashrams, our synagogues, our mosques. That's true. They're not interested in that, because for them, the doorway into spirit is very different. They touch spirit through asking this question, what is my life purpose? What is my gift? How can I offer this gift that I have in service of compassion and justice? Now, I mean, to me, that's spiritual, and it's actually those statements express a very deep spirituality. So I think that it's time, you know, for our spiritual institutions and for our elders to begin to listen to young people, to begin to try to diagnose what is it that they're saying. In our book, Occupy Spirituality, we interviewed and surveyed many young people all over the country. And you know what 95% of them said? They said, we deeply long for mentors, but we can't find any. Now, when I talk to elders and even well-known spiritual teachers, all of them complain that young people don't come to their workshops. There's this disconnect between elders and young people. We don't have bridges that can connect those two generations, and we really need that. You know, that's the only way that we can move forward in a more healthy and sustainable way. And just one last thing about this new spirituality. I feel, as I mentioned before, that this new spirituality is really about young people discovering the essence of who they are, which they experience as being called to do something in the world. And then we need elders who can help them to name what that thing is that they deeply feel. Then we need elders who can help them to build courage to say yes to their deepest aspirations. and empower them to move forward, offering their gifts in service of compassion and justice.
Thank you for that. It is very deeply insightful, and I appreciate it. We're into our final part of the program, and David, I have a thought that is more existential, but let's see if you can give us a perspective that will help bring this together. You know Chris Hedges, correct?
Yes, I do.
All right. I have an enormous amount of respect for Chris. I also see his frustration and at what is not happening. The people are not rallying. The political system is not changing. Those in power are not surrendering one inch. And for a moment, when I look at Chris, I pull back and I think of Nietzsche. I think of Aldous Huxley. I also think of George Orwell, because all of them have different thoughts that come together. The concept that we are given so much information, and most of it trivia, and all of it controlled for a certain outcome. Be a consumer. Don't pay attention where what you bought or used comes from, whether it's safe or not, or whether you can afford it or not. Just use it. And at a certain point, from Aldous Huxley's perspective, you become almost appreciative of being a non-thinking, non-judging, and non-reactive individual. All you do is become a passive spectator to your life, and you just consume and support, and you actually feel fearful if any of that is taken away or if you're asked to be critical in your thought. On the other hand, you have George Orwell, who believes that we are prisoners to totalitarian and fascistic individuals, a society controlled by sociopaths, and therefore your options are limited. Sooner or later, under his system, a dystopian system, we all work for the system, and we're all controlled by it, and we're all taught to fear one another, and we're all told to spy on one another, and everyone is being spied upon. Gee whiz, how prophetic was that? There was recently a release by the government that asked to spy upon each other to see if there's any unusual behavior. Didn't matter what the behavior was, just unusual behavior. Now we're asked that in persons who are going to the doctor, they have to get a psychological profile, not just a medical profile, so it can be in a database to further colonize us. And then you have Nietzsche, who didn't trust any of this, you know, and he was angry, not that you lied to him about anything, but he could not trust you in the future, and that was what made him angry, not the lie itself. And yet every institution today has found a way of betraying us, to lie to us, to manipulate us, from the political system to our religious systems, to our educational system, our financial systems, our energy systems. How do you come to grips with this as, let's say, Chris Hedges, who just feels frustration of challenging with sharper and sharper commentaries, and that seeing nothing, at least not at this time, changing within that paradigm? Your thoughts, please.
That's a big one. The answer, well, I mean, I certainly agree with much of the analysis of Chris Hedges, but we're caught by so many of our heroes and prophets are focused on the failure, and you know it can get really depressing. Okay. Now, a beginning point to change is recognizing that the power of that system is only the power that we yield to it. Now, as individuals, our options are limited. But in concert, we can simply pull away our power from that. Some people refer to it as walking away from the king. Now, in order to do that in concert, you know, on the progressive political side, political action tends to be very fragmented. We each have our individual cause or story of immigrants, gay, lesbian rights, race, inequality. What we miss is the underlying story that runs through all of that, that ultimately it is the same system, and the elements of the system that we're trapped by are things that are human choice. They are not necessarily a conscious collective choice, but they are a collective choice. And if we can make those choices more conscious, we can begin to express our agency. Now, this is, you know, I thought what Adam was saying was wonderful, that I think there is an awakening among young people that is very important, but they don't find a story to rally around. They get this sense that there's a spiritual issue. They want to feel more spiritually connected. but we're dealing with stories that deprive us of a sense of agency. You know, if we buy the story of that distant patriarch in the sky that that created Earth with essentially a magical wave of his hand, we're buying into a story that all agency is out there. If we buy into the science story of all creation is simply a machine playing out mechanical processes and chance, there is no agency anyplace, least of all in us. If we go simply into the spiritual immersion, we don't address the question of agency. But if we begin to frame a story of all of creation as an expression of the spirit emerging, creating, evolving, unfolding, that we are part of a continued unfolding journey of creation in which every being is an agent, is engaged in some way in conscious choice. I mean, if we the mysteries of quantum physics, the mysteries of life are so far beyond what science yet grasps that, you know, if we can begin to pull back and recognize the true mystery and wonder and of that whole process, we begin to realize agency is pervasive, and we are agents, and of all the agents we know, we are the ones that have the greatest power of reflective consciousness, which means the potential capacity to act responsibly with consciousness.
Wow.
And if we begin to learn to apply that, not to simply making money, which is where we get all screwed up, but to making a living as part of a living Earth, which is a community of life, and the purpose is to continue to advance this process of creation toward ever greater complexity, beauty, and possibility, and that gives deep meaning to our lives and gives us a direction in which we can begin to rebuild community, fundamentally reshape our relationship to Earth, and create an economy that honors and serves that process.
David, that beautifully said. My final thought is simple. With these three guests, I believe that they have given us an understanding that our belief systems today at the corporate level are sclerosed. In effect, they need to be dissipated over a period of time before something fresh can be born. And this is universally found in all spiritual traditions, and it can also be applied to the rise and fall of civilizations and cultures and empires. Some say that the America that we know today is at the apex of its imperium and is in the throes of what will be called the Great Death. But something else better will emerge from its ashes. And perhaps this view is the only view people can hope for and work towards, as we all do. We all want a more spiritual existence, a spiritual society. Thank you very much, David Bucco. Thank you very much, Reverend Matthew Fox. And thank you very much, Dr. David Corton.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Gary. Thank you, David.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour and Conversations with Remarkable Minds.